Our world is magical. Games are magical. Open your eyes and prepare to discover how magic and games intersect.
Merry meet and welcome to Covenstead, a podcast about gaming and magic.
This episode is brought to you by Rise Paragon. In this 5e compatible narrative supplement, players each take on the role of a racial paragon, champions and exemplars of their respective cultures. With over 200 new feats, 14 new backgrounds, and GM tools like background-based quest prompts, players are rewarded for aspiring to the ideals of their character's culture as they gain paragon experience, growing more powerful as they begin to embody their culture. Brought to you from our friends at Fool's Moon Entertainment. Back them on Kickstarter in the link in the comments.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Covenstead podcast. It is a windy, blustery day outside, and so what we've done is we've closed all the windows and shuttered everything up, and we have a nice roaring fire that's going in the middle of our Covenstead just to try and keep warm as we finally start getting over these final days of winter and to discuss the final four questions of our Magic System trilogy. And with me, as always, is my coven mate and cohort, Danny. Say hello, Danny.
Hello. Yes, we have Ostara coming up pretty soon on the 20th of the month. So one of the holidays is fast approaching.
Yeah, that would be a good episode, actually. I think we have on the list is to talk about Wiccan holidays, too. That would be a good episode. I'm making a little note about that right now. All right.
Making a note. Yeah, this is how it works, y'all. We just make notes when it comes to us. Yeah, Ostara is the spring equinox. So it means that from that point at that day, the night and the day are the same equal length. And then after that, the days are going to start to get longer as we move into spring and summer.
Mm-hmm. I can't wait for the days to be getting longer. That is for sure. Because then that means I'm going to be able to cut my lawn. And that is one of the things, that's my joy moment, is when I get to actually ride around on like my 2 acres of grass that I cut. It's my outside time, you know, like that. Those are my joy moments right there. So I'm looking forward to those.
Yeah, it's a good time to, plant the seeds of new projects and put your intentions and hope into things for the future as the days get warmer and the world starts to come back to life.
Yes. You know what? And that is something, yeah, I personally could really go for something like that right now. But yeah, for sure. So let's get into it. On the flip side of that, let's complete our trilogy of the 12 questions to ask yourself about your magic system. And we've got from 9 to 12.
Yes.
If you haven't heard the previous two episodes just yet, feel free to definitely go back because there is a kind of a progression where over these last couple episodes, we've been getting into different ways to look at and view these questions. And it's not so much that we've been coming up with a new magic system ourselves, but basically kind of really discussing all the different ways that you could really look at questions like this to create a magic system in your role-playing game, your personal campaign, and take it in some new directions that makes it a little, you know, more interesting in ways that you might not have thought of before. So it's a really interesting thought exercise.
It's been really interesting.
Yeah, yeah. It's been really super cool to do.
So what is question number 9?
How long does it last? And this, aside from, you know, like there's two ways that I've always kind of thought of magic. There's combat magic, which most of the time ends up being kind of an instantaneous thing. You cast it, boom, it has the effect, and then it's done. And then we move on. Roll initiative. But then there's the stuff that is typically more like ritual magic, where, you know, there's a big ceremony or something that is involved. It has a kind of a tenure, so to speak. It lingers until it actually has its effect, actually can go off or any of this other kind of stuff. So I think for question nine, it for me personally, it's kind of like a, you know, how long does magic last? Is there a natural permanence to it? Or is it something that is like for enhanced users, you know, like the more learned practitioners of the craft, so to speak? What do you think, Danny?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. And in our particular case, in Ironbound, it depends. I mean, it depends on what you're trying to do and the context you're trying to do it. So yeah, it can be instantaneous and then it's gone. Or it can be something that's more of a permanent fixture, depending. It depends on what you're doing and what your intention is and the type of energy you put into it. So in our particular case, in our game, it really depends on, you know, what they're trying to accomplish. It can be instantaneous, or they can spend a little bit more time to create a longer lasting effect. So it's really up to the intention and the need of the person doing the magic, and if it works and does what it's supposed to do, and all of those things.
Yeah. Yeah, like in Ironbound, the way that it works is that if you want it to last longer, you need to roll additional successes in order to give it that extra strength so you can place additional conditions onto something. So if you want to cast a spell, but you need it to last like a month's time, or you need it to basically cover your tracks and conceal where you've been moving until the next full moon rises, you know, those are things where the spell initially, at its most basic element, is concealing the tracks. But if you want it to last for a certain amount of time, you need to roll, you know, like two or three successes more to be able to kind of unlock that condition. So it's very plausible. And it's also, too, a really effective reward when a group rolls really high, because nothing can be more disappointing than rolling exceptionally well on something. And it has, like, no possible bonus effect whatsoever. It's the same as if you just barely squeaked over the target number.
Right, right. Exactly, exactly. Yeah.
So, I mean, what's your awesome. Preference?
Yeah, yeah.
What's your preference when it comes to, you know, like, magic? Like, do you like having it where magic is always, like, kind of an instantaneous thing? In a gaming standpoint, I guess, you know, there's two ways I could be asking you this question. In your games, are you a fan of characters that have, like, say, you know, spells, a whole bunch of spells that are, you know, just kind of lingering throughout the world or something like this? Or are you more of a fan of playing the more kind of combat-oriented characters when it comes to their spell use?
I'm trying to think of, like, what I've played. I usually play people usually have more of an instantaneous effect when I'm playing a character. I'm trying to think of, I mean, because even D&D has spells that are permanent and then ones that are instantaneous as well. You know, even the dragon game has a variety of spells, you know? So I guess I'm gonna fudge my answer and say there's a mix.
Yeah.
Like, I prefer, you know, to have a wide arsenal, you know, things that could be more permanent and things that are just, you know, on hand to use quickly as needed.
Yeah. You know, side question, how often do you play a magic user in a role-playing game? I don't know if I've actually asked you that question before.
Oh, relatively often, actually, okay. Thinking about it. You know, I tend to be, I mean, thinking about the characters that I've had, I tend to be kind of extreme with it. You know, I'm either like a really hefty magic user or completely mundane. You know, like either I have all the magic or I have nothing. Yeah. So, oh God. Let me think of the characters that I have right now. Two of them are magic users. And the third is I'm running. So I'm not playing in that one. I'm playing the NPCs. So, But yeah, and one of them, it's kind of default you're a magic user, so I don't know if that counts. But the third character, I chose to be like a shaman magic user. I mean, that's kind of what they call them in the book. I mean, the book is older, and we're playing Werewolf the Apocalypse. And my character is very Umbra magic ritual fetish oriented in that game. So, and bitter about it.
Yes.
As a matter of fact.
Okay, cool. Yeah. No, I was just wondering about that, actually, because it was, it suddenly hit me while we were talking about this, because I know I almost never play magic using characters. It's quite a rarity, and it's one of the, I have kind of like a new bucket list of things I want to do now that I have internet access and an online group, and we're playing our first game this week and all this other kind of stuff. And that's definitely something I want to cross off the list. But yeah, it's almost, I'm almost always refrained from it. But I think that's just the kind of teenage rebellion. Well, everyone's playing magic users, so I'm going to play something different. You know, like, I specifically remember choosing a kit for AD&D called the Wizard Slayer. And they were in the Barbarian splat book. And they were a kind of barbarian who basically automatically gained magic weapon bonuses. Like any attack that they had at a certain level always counted as a +1 magic item. And I just love the idea of a character who didn't need magic being able to fight demons and devils and stuff like this. So I don't think it's for me.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, I don't think for me it's because I've just avoided it. I think it's always been because magic's always been well represented in any kind of fantasy game that I've been in. I've never found myself, you know, looking around going, it's not like a cleric where it's like, oh, no one's the cleric? Oh, shit, I guess I'll be the cleric then. Where it's like someone has got magic somewhere in the party, so we got that covered. I'll be the guy with the swords.
Right. So even if you have, like, a fighter and a magic user? Will you mean, like, let's say you have two other people and, you know, they're doing both. Like, then does it matter to you and you just pick whatever, or?
Yeah, I don't know. I think it also depends on if we're trying to do something that's more of a high fantasy, then I might be inclined to kind of lean into the magical side of things a little bit. But I think it's kind of more of like, you know, a kind of magic that would just augment something that I would do already, you know, to make my character a little bit more superhuman. I think more of like the Lord of the Rings, the Middle Earth elves, as they've been depicted in the movies, in their agility and stuff. I would kind of want to play someone who has a magical ability to be that dexterous rather than someone who casts flamboyant, flashy spells. Like I like playing a character that looks like they have a stunt team and a wire team ready to go, you know, with the drop of a hat.
You're Legolas taking down the Oliphant.
Yeah. But it is something I want to start changing that up. That's something where I'm looking forward to, you know, next opportunity I have to play something where I can be a magical character, really kind of leaning into it. You know, like heavily leaning into it. So yeah, anyways, should we go to question 10?
Cool. Yeah. Let's go to question 10. What's question 10?
Who can use it? And this, I think it seems to me like when you're considering for a role-playing game, the default always seems to be, well, anybody can, you know, it's in a lot of fantasy RPGs. It seems to me, magic is pretty wide open. It's very available. It is definitely the case in Ironbound. You know, it is something that all Nivalans can do. These particular characters have been given special access to it, so to speak, in order to combat a dire threat to the land. But I think it's just almost always a default. I don't recall playing a game where it's a small handful of people have access to it. What about you?
I'm trying to think of, I mean, obviously as a player, Yeah, you can choose to be one of the ones that have magic. But as far as, you know, like whether that magic is, you know, I think I have like games where it is sort of like, you know, only a certain few people have this and you're one of those few people who okay. have these special abilities and stuff like that. Like, I mean, Aberrant, you know, have superhero powers, but not everybody has superhero powers. Most people are mundane. Things I play like Parslings, you know, you become a Parsling, so you have that ability to make things happen. So there are, I think usually, obviously for the player, you usually have magic available to you as a player to pick and use. But I think there are games where like the player is part of a special group of people that can access magic in some games, not all, but I think there are a few out there where, you know, you're part of that special group who has access, you know, either through bloodline or, you know, study or ability or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. It's actually something I just was looking at my gaming shelf and I've got a copy of this old D20 Iron Heroes, which was actually written by Mike Merles, who went on to basically be like the lead developer designer for D&D. And in this, the game is very specifically non-magical. And with an exception of one magic using class, which almost I think is kind of like the equivalent to what we would call a stretch goal these days. It was kind of worked on and it was developed and they snuck it in there by request of fans or something like that. But in general, that like there really were no magic users. And it was, you know, the entire game was very explicit about that kind of thing. That's the only one that I can think of in a game that would be considered fantasy. Anything else I could think of is almost always historical in some way, shape, or form. So like my friend Fraser Ronald, he's made a few games that involve Vikings, but I mean, he's done it from a very historical standpoint. It's about this particular moment in time that is actually well documented and researched and everything like that. You know, to some extent. Yeah, I think it's kind of one of those things. Who can use it almost always seems to be kind of just like this taken for granted of, you know, there's no lineage or anything that, you know, that might be involved. That, you know, it always just seems to be kind of like, you know, it sometimes it's repressed maybe in a society, but it's something that anybody can do. You just need to have access to it and believe in yourself and all this other, you know, stuff that used to make me like, you know, gag as a kid, like, oh, really special?
Yeah.
Ooh.
You know? Yeah. No, I get it. Yeah. I get that. Yeah. I mean, and like I said, just in some cases, you know, the player's part of a group of, like in 7C, you know, you can use magic, but it's only like people who have that in their bloodline, and you can choose as a player to have your character be part of that bloodline or whatever, like, and have the ability to use magic. So it's not everybody, it's a portion of people in 7C that you can choose to either have your character have access to or not. Three of my players had magic, one didn't. You know, but they ran into plenty of people who didn't have magic of any kind and some who did. So, you know, yeah, I mean, there are some out there, but yeah, most of the time, and you do usually have that option as the player.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I think it comes to me, and especially at this point, you know, it's the 10th question and some of the other questions that we've gone into. This one almost kind of seems, I don't know. I would have to say if I were to kind of re-rank these by most awesome questions to the weakest questions, I think I would put this one down at the weakest because I don't know at this point in time, how it's accessed. Like when we were talking about how magic can be accessed and we started coming up with all these different, you know, ways and possibilities that can be introduced and implemented into the game, having it at this point almost kind of seems rather a little kind of self-explanatory. It's like, oh, I think we already covered that. Anyone can use it.
Yeah.
You know, so I think at this point, I could almost say it's like, you know, if at this point you haven't quite figured out who specifically can use it, I would almost say it might be worth going back to some of the earlier questions, because I think it's pretty safe to say that if you've answered the previous 9, you pretty much already know what 10 is going to be. It's almost like number 10 is that, can you confirm your password just to make sure? You know, we just want to make sure we're still on the same page, because,
right,
you know, what you put for question 2 and what you put for question 10 are 2 completely different things. You can't have something that is limited to only 4 people in the world, but any character can use it. It's like, that's not quite the same. That's how I feel. What do you think?
Yeah, right. No, it makes sense. Yeah, I mean, because I remember thinking, like, we discussed a lot of this before in a previous question. So, yeah.
Yeah,
I mean, because access is kind of the same. Who has access is kind of the same as who can do it. You know what I mean? Or how is it accessed? You know?
Yeah.
Because if it was going to be restricted, it'd be like, oh, only people of this bloodline, or only people with this tattoo, or only people with this necklace or whatever can use it. And then, you know, that's how you access it. You know, that kind of answers its own question. The 10th question almost.
Yeah. All right, cool. So let's go to question 11, because we're getting to the part where we're getting to the really good stuff that I've been looking forward to talking about. So question 11, how do others react to it? This is one that for a lot of fantasy gaming that I've played in and read has been so glossed over, where other than the fact that it's just kind of embraced and it's just a part of life and everything like that, I've never really seen something where you're using magic in a world that is very anti-magic. You know, that to me is this kind of interesting dynamic of just like, well, all this stuff is available. It's kind of like asking us in the real world, you know, it's just like, oh, so nuclear weapons are a thing and they're incredibly powerful and destructive and can completely alter the shape of humanity for things to come. But we're all good with it because we use it to power our homes. Everything's happy. You know, no one worries about a thing. That to me is almost kind of, you know, magic in so many cases is something you can wish something to completely change. You can completely alter reality in D&D and other kind of base clones with a wish spell that changes everything. There are monsters that can do that at whim. And the fact that everyone's just kind of cozy about magic, to me is, and as I've gotten older, almost felt kind of like a, you know, I've kind of seen that before. I'd like to see something where magic is considered a bit of a fringe, maybe. What do you think?
Yeah. So it's kind of funny. I actually, have you played Great American Witch?
No, I actually haven't. I don't even know if I've actually read it. I backed the Kickstarter, but I don't think I've actually gone and read it.
It's kind of like that. Witches are not, I mean, they know each other, but as far as the general population, people don't know that real witches exist. And part of it is that they have a responsibility, you know, they all do different things. And so they do it under secrecy, essentially. One of them, you know, like the different groups have different purposes that you can pick from for your coven in that game. And a lot of it has to do with like preserving the balance or maintaining the veil and making sure like one of them, you know, making sure regular people don't find out about magic and stuff like that. So I know there's at least one game where you are very charmed in that way, where they're witches and they're doing stuff, but the general population doesn't know that they exist. So part of it is a secrecy, you know, know, sort of like in Vampire the Masquerade, where you have the Masquerade, your part of your job is keeping the fact that vampires exist from the people. So things like D&D don't have anything like that, but I do know some games, that one is the first one that came to mind. And Parcelings, I say those because I played them, yeah. Where what you can do is kind of on the down low, and not everybody should know about it or does know about it. You know, you kind of get introduced to this secret world, essentially.
Yeah. You know what? Now that you're mentioning the fact, I have not even been considering urban fantasy in any of this. I've just been... You can tell I'm pushing 50. I'm becoming such a purist of just like, no, my fantasy existed only in the 1970s. That's when we perfected it. But yeah, urban fantasy, urban fantasy and the secret world. Yeah, that's true. That's something that happens. And in most cases, that secret world is because humanity would turn on magic users if they discovered that we were real, and you know, a lot of this other kind of stuff, or humanity wouldn't be able to cope with the fact, you know, that magic exists and everything. Yeah, urban fantasy is quite ripe with that, where magic is kept, you know, on the down low.
Yeah.
Even to the World of Darkness games, there were, which I've never played and never read, heard a lot about, though, was Mage the Ascension, and the idea of mages actually existing in the real world. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and mages have, you know, they have a, oh, I forget what they call it, too, in the book, and I've played Mage. Yeah, is it the Ascension or the Awakening or something like that? But there's a moment when... You come into your ability as a mage. There's like an unlocking that happens due to an event that happens. In World of Darkness, Hunter is that way too.
Yes,
you are there as a person, regular Joe or whatever, going about your business, and then you have an encounter with a supernatural being, and then you are called by the messengers, whatever those are. Nobody knows. To become a hunter, and you get abilities, and you have that moment where that stuff gets unlocked in you. And depending on how your encounter is your what they call creator philosophy of how you deal with monsters, depending on what interaction you had with them and how you felt about that interaction. So, yeah, I mean, urban fantasy games and abilities and things like that do tend to go that route. There are a couple where, you know, it's just part of the urban fantasy landscape where that happens. You know, people just, you know, the world is this way now, and there are people who are this now, and everybody kind of is. So, you know, but a lot of urban fantasy games do have some of that secret world stuff going on.
Yeah. And I think that it's interesting. It's, you know, you could take that back. And if, once again, how we've talked about how magic can actually play an allegorical role in the world, where you might actually be talking about immigration, in a sense, you know, like, or running parallels to it, where those who, mm-hmm. you know, have access to magic users, are basically trying to, you know, ingratiate themselves and trying to become part of this other world where people don't use magic. There's a lot of really interesting ways that can go. I remember, and I think we talked about this in a previous episode too, Jason Pitt has an ashcan for a game called Circles of Power, where only people from marginalized communities are actually able to cast magic. And it's about them basically trying to make their way in a world of non-magic users. And it's a really mm-hmm. interesting way of using magic to kind of play that parallel that still allows you to work within a very fictionalized world. And I think, you know, like we've talked about before, that kind of stuff is really fascinating. And I think that's one of the things that this question can do, is really make you think, okay, how is a way that magic is going to affect the game on a more social level.
Right.
You know, you've gone into how it physically affects the world, how it morally affects the world. Now we're talking about how do people personally look at these kind of things? Right. You know, that's the part right. where I think it's really getting interesting.
Yeah. And as far as Novella goes, I mean, we've discussed before, you know, magic is something that pretty much everybody does. So their reaction to it would not, like, a regular, you know, just not iron bound, you know, regular Novellan living their life and doing magic in their day to day life. You know, nobody, how they wouldn't blink an eye at it in Novella, because, you know, everybody does some magic, everybody does that sort of thing. They have group celebrations and group magic and all that stuff. So they wouldn't blink an eye at it. What would come up would be how you're using it and, you know, what you're doing with it and all of that stuff. You know, someone might have an adverse effect to, adverse reaction to. But as far as just being able to do magic yourself, no one would blink an eye about it. Though they might, like I said, they might have issue with what you're doing with it. But, you know.
Yeah. Well, and there's the apothecary. They could, you know, in our case, they are the others who are reacting to this magic. And they're not reacting to it in the sense of, oh, what a wonderful, beautiful thing. It's kind of more of like, you know, that we could use that like gasoline, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's, you know, in our particular case, that's how those are our others, you know, and how they're reacting to magic and everything. But
yeah,
something I've started playing with a little bit in some of the Ironbound stuff that I've been running is the idea of that there are different ways that people use magic within Novella, and how there have been some, it hasn't always gone peacefully, so to speak, where, you know, there's been like no open conflict or anything like that, but there's always like little rumors that, you know, kind of stir. There's a, you know, people who primarily use their magic to transform into animals as like their intrinsic gift. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, they're seen as being a little bit kind of behind in the times, and you know, spell casting is a more dignified way of using magic. Little bits and rumors and stuff like that, just to kind of, because for me, those are the things that really kind of show kind of depth in the world, and that something is much larger. And it also kind of helps me establish what region that they're in by using dialogue.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, just like tiny little, you could even call them division. I mean, and some of that comes from me living in a small town where there's a reason why I listen to music while I do grocery shopping, is because I get really tired of overhearing all the different gossip that's going on in the aisle. So for me, that's part of rural society. It's like,
yeah,
I was...
I heard it.
Yeah, I was explaining to somebody once that, you know... he's an Asian Canadian, and he was saying, is like, well, at least, you know, like, you're also white out there, so you'll be able to fit in no problem. And I'm like, no, I think what happens is that when there's no, you know, visible minorities for some white people to find, they start turning on each other. It's just part of this, you know, rooster mentality of just like, well, I got to start pecking somebody around, and then we turn on each other, and that's how it manifests as people gossiping in the grocery aisle. So maybe that's just my own biases coming into the game.
I once heard somebody describe, I mean, because I grew up in an extremely small town, like very, very small town, small village almost in Vermont. And, you know, it's sort of like somebody put it once. It's like being part of a group chat you never signed up for.
Yes.
Like, you know, you just hear all this stuff, you know.
Yeah. So, yeah, this question, I think, is one of these things where, you know, it's a chance to really kind of, and even then, too, not everybody wants to. I mean, for quite a few people, I know when the pandemic really hit, I was getting involved in certain discussions, and everyone was just like, okay, and talking about the types of games they want to start running now. And there were quite a few people who were like, no, I want to go back to Heroic. I want to go to very simple, you know, good guy, bad guy kind of thing. The real world is far too gray at the moment. I need things very nice and clear. And so this question can easily be something where it's like, nope, that's not part of the aesthetic. It's the same as, you know, wanting to incorporate, aspects of racism into the My Little Pony cartoon. It's like, yeah, you could, but you really got to be very careful about that, and not everyone's going to dig it.
Right. Right. I mean, because we've discussed, you know, that in Novella, you know, not everyone thinks the same way, you know. Because we really wanted to avoid, I mean, when we first started out, you know, Novella seemed very, utopian. No one had any problems and you know, everyone agreed and all of this stuff. And you and I both know that that's not the case, you know. And while they do live in harmony with the land and all of that sort of thing, you know, they do have disagreements. They do have arguments about what they should do. You know, personalities clash just like they do with any other group of sentient beings. You know,
yeah. It's I guess it's a bit of the realism. I guess that is something that I guess not realism necessarily, but part of the believability in that everyone has these tiny little flaws. And I think it fits with a lot more modern gaming because the idea of failing forward as a mechanical aspect of the game, not just a narrative one, has become so popular that I think the idea of then having, like, you know, these kind of little flaws of just like, you know, okay, yeah, it's all not perfect. Yeah, I mean, yes, it's great. Like in Novella, life is very prosperous in a sense. For the Novalan people, they're well rewarded for their choices and lifestyles and how they live with the land and, you know, how they use magic without overusing magic. But at the same time, too, you know, having them just basically all be tra-la-la, like basically turning the Novalans into human Smurfs. It's like, now that's a little too simple. That's not quite what we were going for. You know, we wanted these characters to be real and complex. And also, too, because it's a game that's based on Wiccan beliefs and because Wicca is so personal to people, that means it has to be wide. It has to be varied. It's like there has to be room in the game for an Oscar the Grouch character, you know, a Muppet specifically created to teach kids. You're not going to like everybody, but you can still get along with them, you know, to have that where you've got the grouchy curmudgeon in the back of their party.
Right, right. And here's the thing, you know, yes, the Novalans have, you know, lived with the land and the way they use magic and stuff like that. But the thing that people have to remember about magic and life and being good and being balanced and all that stuff is that it's a constant series of choices. You know, it's a constant series of choices that you are making to act like that. We're not talking about people who are just doing what they do and it comes easy and they're just completely balanced and everything like that. It's choice. It's a choice to do that. It's a choice to put in that work. It's a choice to live that way. Constantly choosing every day and in the actions that you do to live that way. And there's something compelling about those choices that you have to make in order to maintain that balance or maintain the relationship that Novalan have with Novella itself, right? There's an interesting dynamic to be studied there of that you are constantly making that choice to be good. One thing that I use, and this has to do with being addicted to anything, and I heard it first, I think, from Roger Ebert, who had a problem with alcohol at one point, and I smoked for a long time. And he said something that was really profound, and that was extremely true. You don't not drink anymore or not smoke anymore. you know, you just choose not to do it that day. The need is there. You just choose not to do it. It's not a one battle that you can win, you know. I still get cravings for cigarettes, you know, and the choice not to do it is the choice that I'm making. And there's something compelling in that, that I think we explore with Novella. In that, yes, they have this life and synergy and this balance and this relationship with the land that they have cultivated. But for each individual person, it is a choice that they make to do that every single day with how they do things. They always have a choice to steer away from that path. And the conundrums that happen and the choices that you make to maintain that are the interesting part, especially for the Ironbound, who now have a sort of extra task that most Novalans don't have. If that makes sense at all. My long rant.
Yeah. Long rants are our specialty on this show. Yeah. So, no, I think it's also one of those things where, like, to me, the idea of an adventuring party where you've got two characters that are from completely different backgrounds, and even to the point, like, the idea of a paladin with a thief. And... you know, having someone who is supposed to be completely law-abiding with someone who is very willing to be law-breaking, how does that dynamic work? To me, it's only problematic when it's everything is taken as absolutes and it's just like, well, no, he stole something, so I have to cut his hand off. Well, hold on a sec. That's a completely... we need to go back to session zero now. But having where it's just like they exchange dirty looks at first and... you know, like it's the Gimli and Legolas situation where they're just diametrically opposed to each other without actually knowing each other. But as they travel together and get to know each other better, we see this incredible friendship that's building. And that's way more interesting than knowing that Aragorn and, the Prince of Gondor. Damn, I just forgot his name. Nuts.
Boromir?
Teenage me is going to be, there we go, Boromir. Teenage me is going to be so disappointed. But, you know, it's nice to know that Aragorn and Boromir are kind of made up toward the end and stuff like this, but it means very little compared to what Gimli and Legolas have because we know how it started. It's a more interesting dynamic in the long run.
Right. And then you get into cool situations in a game like that where, you know, to use your thief and paladin example, like the paladin looks the other way, perhaps, when the thief does something, you know, for the greater good or whatever. You know what I mean? Or, you know, the thief chooses not to do something and claims, you know, he just didn't want to, but he's really doing it because, you know, the morality of the paladin is sort of rubbing off on them or whatever. You know, you get those sorts of interactions where they're influencing each other and learning from each other. And, you know, those are some of the great moments, you know, that you have in a game.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think going back to question 11, how do others react to this magic system? I think that's a really interesting way for it to develop in the game where you have characters that have different ways of accessing magic. And what are the stereotypes that come with that? And then, you know, that creates really great role-playing moments. It doesn't even have to be something mechanical in the game. It could just be like these kind of little elements of, you know, just how someone might kind of look dirty. It could even just be the sense of you're using magic for personal gain. That's wrong. My people believe that it's all magic is to be for the benefit of others. And, you know, but then that character suddenly finds out that the one who uses magic to steal is doing it to feed their family or to help out an orphanage, you know, that's been down on its luck and everything like that. And that changes the dynamic. Yeah. You know, it creates really interesting role-playing ways on how people see magic in this world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So what's the 12? Do we have 12? We have 12 left to do, right?
We have 12 left to do. Okay. This one is my absolute favorite.
Yeah, right.
And I can't help but notice on the list, the little screenshot of the list that we have, that number 12 is bold. So I really feel like the creator of this list, who is simply going by the name of Metty V. Harrison, so I'm going to assume that that's correct, but that they really want you to pay attention to this question.
All right.
Question 12.
Hit me with it.
Why haven't people with this power taken over the world? And that right there is, yeah, why haven't people taken over with this kind of, like, the way magic is always is framed and provided for the player characters. It's just like, what's to stop somebody from just taking it and charming everybody? You know, let's go to urban fantasy that I've been ignoring. Urban fantasy, if there was a way that you could cast a charm spell through the television or through the internet, what's to stop somebody from just all of a sudden, boom, one day, charm everybody that's watching this live stream of millions of people? You know, that's to me, it's like, oh, now you've got something. If the back of the box or the back of the book is going to explain, you know, what somebody evil is now going to do with this power, you got me hooked personally.
Right. Yeah. I mean, Yeah, that's an interesting question. Well, I think in some cases, I mean, before we get into Naval specifically, I think in some cases, like, the power isn't great enough. You know what I mean? To do that in some case. And just in some cases, you know, it's not powerful. I mean, you can control a certain area, and especially in D&D, that happens. You know, you get an area that's controlled by this wizard or whatever, you know. But there's also other wizards out there, you know, and keeping each other in check and all of that stuff. So in some cases, there is a limitation. You know, your power will only be so influential, right? It's not earth-shattering power, necessarily. And in some cases, there's a cost to using power. You know, you get taint or you get corrupted or whatever in some games, and that prevents it. Because the creators of the game realized that that would be a problem, so they had to put some sort of stopgap in the game to be like, okay, just so the players don't do, you know, let's create a cost for the consequences of using, you know, this magic. And I think in the case of Novala, one, because the magic relies on consent a lot of times, so you're going to throw everything off. So that often keeps people in check. Like, most people, you know, don't want to throw the world off balance or kill animals or kill off nature or anything like that. So most Novalans are kept in check, quote unquote, and knowing what will happen if they overstretch or overuse magic or use it in ways that aren't, you know, the way it's supposed to be used in terms of balancing and stuff like that. And the people who aren't, you know, it becomes a lot harder when there's not consent in the terms of World of Novala. You know, we've talked about Novala as being a character in and of itself. And so the magic that you're allowed is via consent. It's via living as a part of the world and being part of the ecosystem. And if you take yourself out of that ecosystem or try to give yourself a different place in that ecosystem, it's going to be a lot harder for you, you know, than anything else. And plus, the type of magic that most Novalans do isn't really that type of take over the world magic in any case. You know, Ironbound are the ones that have kind of that instant power sort of thing to help fight the apothecary, but that's not every Novalan. You know, most Novalans are, you know, small money spells or prosperity spells or you know, crop rituals or things like that. You know what I mean? Because they haven't been given that benefit, which Novala has put upon Ironbound to be able to help as a balancing force to fight back against the apothecary, who are not doing so great things. So, you know, it's kind of one of those nature balancing itself kind of things that most Novalans use. And even if it doesn't, the power isn't quite that kind of earth-shattering, take over the world, become a tyrant sort of power anyway, you know, to begin with. I don't know. What do you think?
I think the Nivalans, for them, magic is something that has to be sustained. Like, it's not something that can just be drained and depleted. There's only so much water is going to be in the well at a time. You have to use it slowly so that it allows it to, you know, stay at a good full level. If you suddenly drain all the water, it could be weeks until it comes back again, or it might never come back again. So, yeah, to me, with Nivala, it's basically just been a case of they understand how magic works, and how it needs to be kept going, how it needs to be fed, replenished, and then be utilized. That's one of the things where, and especially too, why Ironbound has such a very environmentalist message to the game, because the way that we presented magic is very much an environmental allegory, in the sense of, like, you know, like, there's someone who is coming to take this from these people who have taken such great pains and efforts to show it great respect and dignity, and to revere it while still using it as a resource, so to speak. You know, it's much like where some, you know, traditional hunters would actually say a prayer, and they would thank the spirit of the animal for giving its life in order to, you know, feed their village and everything like that. It's the same way with the people in the Valin. That's, you know, so that's why you never really would expect any of them to say, rise up and be like, you know what, I think this entire land should be under one king. And you know what, I think it should be me. I'm going to use this access to magic, and I'm, you know, it's just not a thing for them. They're a very regional,
right?
Well, I guess they're not rural. There are big cities and everything, but they are very much a simple people who, you know the responsibility they have. If they're going to use magic, they have to do so responsibly, or it'll get taken away from them.
Right. You know, magic is a resource, and just like any resource, you have to use it sustainably. Because it's finite, or you won't have access to it anymore, you know. So most Nivalans realize, you know, not using it sustainably. That's not to say it hasn't ever happened, you know what I mean? I mean, there are Nivalans who, you know, want certain things or whatever, might try to do those things. But, you know, usually, you know, gets thrown down, or is very constricted to one certain area or something like that. You know what I mean? It's a much less world shattering than most places, because you know, what we have that's kind of changing landscape thing is something that came in to the land, the apothecary, who are, you know, have different philosophy on that whole thing, you know, about, you know, but most Nivalans realize it needs to be a sustainable resource in order to be able to use it, and the resource has some say in how it's used anyway. So
yes,
it's not passive. You know, there's another relationship in there. It's not just a tool to be used, it's a tool to be granted access to use in ways that are approved, I guess, for lack of a better word to put it.
Yeah. You can almost look at it as casting a spell is more so requesting permission to use the magic in this fashion. It says, like, oh, would you help me with this? I've been having trouble getting my crops to grow. I could use a little help. And you're nice about it, and you use the right gestures, you use the correct words, and you show the appreciative, you know, amount of respect. And the magic says, oh, sure, I'll help you out with that. Versus it's just like, you know, damn it, magic, I need you to make this thing grow. You know, like, I'm trying to make money here and sell these crops. And magic's just like, well, you don't have to be rude about it. It's 3 a.m. I'm trying to sleep. So,
yeah, exactly.
I like that. I like that approach to it, where it's basically they have this relationship with magic where it's a spell is knowing how to ask. And when Nivala basically, when you take the naming ritual and you become one of the Ironbound, basically the magic is saying, it's basically 1980s, you know, commando style, handing you a series of guns and saying, go out there and kick some ass.
Yeah. Anything else? I mean, we are coming up upon an hour. Do we have any last, it's been fun answering these questions the past three episodes, and thinking about it and fleshing everything out.
Yeah. So, well, let's wrap this up with, let me ask you a question and then, you know, like, and I'll feel free to answer it as well. But after going through these 12 questions and discussing it like we have and everything like that, has it kind of sparked anything new that you want to try out, like with a character down the road, or, you know, sparked an idea for that next campaign that you're thinking about running or anything?
I think what it did was solidified where we were going, you know, and what we're doing. Nice. So it was kind of like a fleshing out and confirmation and putting into words where we want to go and what our philosophy is about all of this stuff. So rather than having any great new insights or anything like that, it was more of a confirmation and being able to put it into words and discussing it and solidifying that we were kind of on the same page and how do we feel about these things and kind of a confirmation of stuff we kind of already had, I think.
Yeah. Nice. And I would agree with that. At no point in time did any of these questions make me stop and think. It's just like, oh, you know, I don't know if we ever considered that before. I think if anything, it was really interesting to hear how your takes differed on certain ways or different areas that you had thought about and considered these things before when it came to Nevala. But yeah, I think this was really good. And even then too, I find it's giving me some ideas on ways that I could approach it later on. Particularly too, I'm kind of looking forward to sometime down the road being able to run Ironbound using one of the different approaches. Like right now I run it as a water guide. So I'm very helpful and everything else like this. When the time comes and if I get to play as a fire guide or an earth guide where it's very grim and everything like that, I definitely want to come back to these questions and kind of look at how they can help me,
right?
You know, make that grittier game, make that more intense game and everything like that. So they're really good questions. Mm-hmm. Even if it's something where you've built a system already, they're really good ways to kind of check and see if you've actually made exactly what it is that you thought you did. And if you start looking at these questions and you're just like, oh, well, that doesn't apply, and suddenly you're shrugging off half the list, you know, it might be worth kind of reconsidering it because, yeah, it's a really good comprehensive list. I really like this, and I'm really glad that we did it in three parts too. Rule of three. Come on. Even I know now that that's a big thing.
Yeah. That's, you know, we had some really good discussions, and hopefully anybody listening, you know, thinks about it too. And if you have any other questions you think might be a good addition to the list, go ahead and let us know. And, you know, talk with us about it. What questions do you think we missed or what was surprising to you? Or what about your own systems? Would answering these questions be helpful to you? And, yeah, I mean, just let us know what you think. Anything else, Todd?
I think we're good. I think we can close out our 12 question trilogy going here. But before we
I think we're going to do the same thing. And if you have a game that has magic, witches, or you're Wiccan yourself, and playing and you would like to come and chat with us, please let us know. Is that what you were going to say?
That is exactly what I was going to say. Actually, that's what it was. that's okay. It was the one thing that we rehearsed, that we kind of talked about before recording, which we never do. Because we just like, okay, this is what we're talking about. Okay, roll it. I'm ready for it. So anyways, yeah, it is one of those things. We are at the moment, each of us are talking with a couple of people about trying to have them come on the show you know, they have a game that specifically involves paganism or witchcraft in a role-playing game scenario, or they are somebody who has, you know, who is a pagan of one way or another and also happens to be a game designer. You know, we kind of would like to, you know, bring as many as possible, not all at once, obviously, that could be a little cacophonous, but, you know, to have a chance to kind of see how, you know, how those beliefs actually affect a game's design in the way that it did for us when we were working on Ironbound, you know, where you're trying to design something that replicates a belief system. And how people see their purpose on this earth and everything. And it can be a really interesting thought exercise, you know, on so many different levels. So yeah, if you're somebody that thinks, if you think that this show is right on brand with what you're doing or who you are as a game designer, we would love to have you on this show and we would like to talk and we would like to pick your brain.
Yeah, for sure. Todd will get tired of picking mine.
It's more. No, never. Never. Never, never, never.
Yeah, absolutely. So let us know. Give us a shout. Let us know about your game or let us know about your experience and what you might want to talk about. And until then, I hope you have a little magic in your gaming and a little gaming in your magic. We'll talk to you later.
Bye, everybody.
The Covenstead Podcast was created and produced by Danielle Delisle and Todd Crapper. Theme music written and composed by John Thompson from the Rook and Rask channel on Twitch. Definitely check them out.
Special thanks to all of our backers. Alex, Tim Brannan, Chris Atrata, Century Guild, Nicholas Diak, Fool's Moon Entertainment, Kaboom.com, -50s, no apologies. Brian P. Kurtz, Jason LeDuc, Civ Light, Revna, Derek Simsek, Danielle Thomas, Phil Watson, Jacob Wood, and Victor Wyatt.
Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.